What we will do next, I will say, turn with me if you will. This one's easy to find anyway. Just go to chapter 19 of the book of Bamidbar, or in the wilderness. The English name is often referred to as Numbers, because there's a lot of those in here. But the whole book does take place, Bamidbar, in the wilderness. And chapter 19 begins, as so many of them do, the first unique word is coming up in the second verse, but it says this, "And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe, and unto Aaron, and lay Amar." Here's what he told him. And here then are the words in red. These are Huchat, and it's plural, the statutes of the Torah which Yahuwah commanded, saying, "Speak unto the B'nai Israel that they bring bring a red heifer." So this is considered to be kind of like the hook of all the hooks, the one that Solomon famously was thought to have said, "Hey, you know, I realize that this idea of a hook is something that we just do it because he says so, but I got to admit, I don't understand this one." So he didn't understand it. There are certainly, now that we have an understanding of the Mashiach, some parallels that are more clear. But yeah, admittedly, there's a lot about this one that, do it because he says so. So, bring a red heifer, faultless, wherein there's no blemish, and upon which has never come a yoke. Now, quick aside here, these red heifers, as it turns out, and the rabbis are pretty picky. When it says red, they mean really red, and not any, I think the rabbinic rule, and I'm not sure where they came up with this, but is no more than 3 white hairs on the whole animal. So they are pretty rare. And there haven't been all that many in the whole history of the time since this was written. But bring a red heifer, faultless, when there's no blemish, no yoke. Give her then to Eleazar the priest. She'll be brought forth outside the camp, and be slain before his face, and Eleazar the priest shall take of her blood with his finger, sprinkle of it towards the front of the tent of meeting 7 times. And the heifer shall then be burnt in his sight, along with the skin, the dung, all of her blood, everything, all burnt. The priest then takes cedar wood and hyssop and scarlet, casts it into the midst of the burning heifer, and then he washes his clothes. He shall bathe his flesh in water. Afterwards he may come into the camp, but the priest shall be unclean until evening. So here's another one of the characteristics of the red heifer. Sometimes, you know, we joke about this, but it is kind of an interesting take. The red heifer is the thing that cleanses people from death, and yet everyone that comes in contact with it, that deals with setting it up and preparing it, is unclean, at least until evening. He that burns her, he too shall wash his clothes in water, bathe his flesh in water. He's unclean till evening. And a man that is clean shall gather up the ashes of the heifer, lay them up outside the camp in a clean place, and there it shall be kept for the congregation, for the edah of the B'nai Israel, for a water of sprinkling, for purification from sin. So this is the real, if you will, set apart holy water, the water for purification. He that gathers the ashes of the heifer shall wash his clothes. He too is unclean until evening, and it'll be unto the children of Israel and unto the stranger that sojourns among them a huk, a statute. So it's le huchat olam, forever. He that touches the dead, a dead man's body, is unclean, it says in the next verse, for 7 days. So having laid this out, here's what we're going to talk about doing with the water that comes from the ashes of the the water of purification based on the ashes of the red heifer. So man is, he's been in contact with a dead body. He's unclean for 7 days. That same person shall purify himself therewith, in other words, with this water, on the 3rd day and on the 7th day, and he'll be clean. But if he doesn't do that, purify on the 3rd and the 7th day, he shall not be clean. Whosoever touches the dead, the body of any man that's dead, and does not purify himself, he has defiled the Mishkan of Yahuwah. That soul shall be cut off from Israel, because the water of sprinkling wasn't dashed against him. He shall be unclean. His uncleanness is still upon him. Again, one of the things that I think should come through in this is how this idea of death is pervasive, and this stench of death, if you will, the contagion of death, tends to make people that deal with it unclean. This, it says, is HaTorah, the instruction. When a man dies in a tent, everyone that's in that tent or comes into the tent, and everything that's in the tent shall be unclean for 7 days. Any open vessel which didn't have a covering, clothes bound upon it, is unclean. And whoever is in an open field and touches someone who is slain with a sword, or someone that dies of himself, or the bone of a man, or a grave, shall be unclean for 7 days. So basically, all this contact with the dead, unclean for 7 days. And for the unclean, they shall take of the ashes of the burning of the purification from sin. Running water shall be put thereto in a vessel. And a clean person now takes hyssop, dips it in the water, sprinkles it upon the tent where this dead person was, right? Upon all the vessels, upon the persons that were in there, upon him that touched the bone, or the slain, or the dead, or the grave. And the clean person shall sprinkle upon the unclean on the third day, and again on the seventh day. And on the seventh day he shall purify him. He washes his clothes, bathes himself in water, and after that he shall be clean at evening. But the man that doesn't do this, he shall be unclean. That soul shall be cut off from the midst of the assembly, because he has defiled the sanctuary of Yahuwah. Water sprinkling has not been dashed against him. He remains unclean. And this, it says, is another. It's a lehuchat olam, a perpetual statute. He that sprinkles the water of the sprinkling shall wash his clothes. He that touches the water of the sprinkling shall be unclean until evening. And whatsoever the unclean person touches also is unclean, and the soul that touches him is unclean until evening. So again, this idea of death and how it is, I like the word contagious in this context. It's an uncleanness that is spread by contact with death. And we'll see that that's kind of a theme that's going to permeate a lot of Scripture. And if you think about it, it makes sense, and there would be an obvious connection, although it's not clear exactly how it plays out with the Mashiach and the things that he came to do. All right, and the B'nai Israel, it says, even the whole congregation came into the wilderness of Zin in the first month. People abode there in Kadesh, and Miriam died there and was buried there. So chapter 20 begins, and you have to ask the question, well, Miriam's going to die. How long have they been in the wilderness? Rashi's claim is, well, everyone who was sentenced to die, right, your carcasses will fall in the wilderness. He suggests that by the time we get to this point in the book, in the story, that has happened. All of those that were going to die have done so. Now, there was no water, again, for the congregation, so they assembled themselves together. We've seen this before, against Moshe and against Aaron. People strove with Moshe, and they spoke. And have we ever heard this before? You can imagine this is going to kind of wear thin with Moses at this point. Oh, we whine, we sure wish we had perished when our brethren perished there before Yahuwah. Why, oh, why have you brought us, the assembly of Yahuwah, into this wilderness to die here, we and all of our cattle? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us into this evil place? There's no seed, no figs, no vines, no pomegranates now, nor is there any water to drink. So Moshe and Aaron went from the presence of the assembly to the door of the tent of meeting. They fell upon their faces, and the glory of Yahuwah appeared to them. So far, so good. You can understand that they're justifiably frustrated. It's not like we haven't seen this before. They've been dealing with this for four decades now. Yahuwah spoke to Moshe, and he said, now listen carefully, because it's important what Yahuwah says. Take the rod. Take the rod and assemble Kol Adad, the congregation, you and Aaron your brother, and speak unto the rock before their eyes, that it shall give forth its water. And you shall bring forth to them water out of the rock. So you shall give the congregation and their cattle water to drink. So Moshe took the rod from before Yahuwah as he commanded him. So far, so good. Moshe and Aaron gathered the assembly together before the rock, and he said to them, and at this point it sounds like maybe the train is leaving the tracks. Hear now, you rebels! Are we going to have to bring you water forth from out of this rock? Moshe lifted up his hand, and he smote the rock with his rod. Not once, but twice. Water came forth abundantly, and the congregation drank along with their cattle. So, whatever he did, water came out. I guess it's not the people's fault that Moshe doesn't seem to listen here. Maybe he's operating in frustration, but as we know, and as we're going to see again when we read the story, it's going to cost him. Yahuwah then said unto Moshe and unto Aaron, because you didn't believe me, You didn't listen. You failed to believe me to the point where you failed to obey, to sanctify me in the eyes of the B'nai Israel. Therefore, you shall not bring this assembly into the land which I have given them. These, it says in verse 13 here, are the waters of Meribah, which literally means strife or contention, and that certainly fits, where the B'nai Israel strove with Yahuwah, and he was sanctified in them. Moshe sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. Now, we're all of a sudden kind of changing gears. It's almost like that happened, and you're not going to bring him into the land, and the story moves on. But as we're going to see, there's more to it. Moshe sent messengers from Kadesh unto the king of Edom. And he says, thus says your brother Israel, you know all the travail that's befallen us, how our fathers went down into Egypt, how we dwelt there a long time, and the people of Mitzrayim, they dwelt ill with us and our fathers. When we cried unto Yahuwah, he heard our voice. He sent a malach, a messenger, an angel. He brought us forth out of Mitzrayim, and behold, here we are in Kadesh, a city in the uttermost of your border. So we're right at the border of your land. Here's the request. Let us pass, I pray you, through your land. We will not pass through fields, nor vineyards, nor will we drink of the water of the wells. We'll just go along the king's highway. We won't turn aside to the right hand or to the left until we have passed beyond your border. And Edom responds and says, you shall not pass through me, through this land, lest I come out with the sword against you. And the children of Israel said unto him, well, we'll go up by the highway. If we drink of your water, I and my cattle, then we'll pay you the price for it. Only just let me pass through on my feet. We're not going to hurt anything. And he said, you shall not pass through. So it doesn't matter. Nope, you ain't coming in. And Edom came out with him with many people and with a strong hand. Thus, says the book, Edom refused to give Israel passage through his border. Wherefore, Israel turned away from him. So that didn't work. They journeyed from Kadesh, and the B'nai Israel, the whole congregation, came unto Mount Hor. And it's literally Har Hor. And Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and Aaron there in Har Hor by the border of the land of Edom. And he said the following, Aaron shall be gathered unto his people, because he ain't going to enter the land which I have given unto the B'nai Israel, because, remember, you rebelled against my word at the waters of Meribah. You literally rebelled against my mouth, is the way the Hebrew reads. So, you take Aaron and Eleazar his son, bring him on up unto Mount Hor, and strip Aaron of all of his garments, put him upon Eleazar his son. So, put those garments on Eleazar his son, is where we are. This is in chapter 20, verse 26. And Aaron will be gathered unto his people, and he will die there. So Moshe did as Yahuwah commanded. They went up unto Mount Hor in the sight of all of the congregation, Kol Ha'edah, and Moses stripped Aaron of his garments. He put him on Eleazar his son, and Aaron died there on the top of the mountain, and Moshe and Eleazar came down from the mountain, just the two of them. And at this point it says, when all the congregation saw that Aaron was dead, they wept for Aaron 30 days, even Kol Beit Israel, all of the house of Israel. Chapter 21 says, the Canaanite, king of Arad, who dwelt in the south, he'd heard that Israel came by the way of Atharim, and he fought against Israel, took some of them captive. And Israel vowed a vow to Yahuwah, said, if you will indeed deliver this people into my hand, then I will utterly destroy their cities. So Yahuwah hearkened, he, Shemad, to the voice of Israel. He delivered up the Canaanites. They utterly destroyed them in their cities. The name of the place was called Hormah. And they journeyed from Mount Hor, Hahor, by way of the Sea of Reeds to encompass, in other words, go around the land of Edom. And the soul of the people became impatient because it was a long way. And guess what happened? People spoke against Elohim and against Moshe, and they said, oh, good grief, right? How many times have we got to hear this? Why have you brought us up out of Egypt to die here amid bar in the wilderness? Because there's no bread and there's no water, and our soul just loathes this detestable, this light, this contemptible, this worthless bread, this lechem. But they're talking about the manna, folks. So guess what happened? Yahuwah sent fiery serpents. Now, this is the first time we see this word, and it's ha-nachashim ha-seraphim. Kind of rhymes. It's great Hebrew alliteration. Ha-nachashim ha-seraphim. fiery serpents. The word has to do with coppery colored, and of course, nachashim. Nachash is the thing that we see in Genesis 3, this serpent creature, the thing that beguiled and deceived Eve, Chava. And singular is nachash, so nachashim is plural, lots of them. And they bit people, and a whole lot of folks died, it says. So people came to Moshe, and they said, you know what? We have sinned because we've spoken against Yahuwah and against you. So, hey, tell you what, pray to Yahuwah that he take away these nachashim from us. So Moshe did. He prayed for the people. And Yahuwah said unto Moshe, now this is interesting too. It's almost ironic. I think it makes sense that in the same portion, Parsha, where we see this hook of the red heifer, we're going to see something else that's red. It's also one of those, scratch your head, why is he saying this? How and why does this work? Well, just do it, right? It's a hook. So Yahuwah says to Moshe, make yourself a fiery serpent. Not a red heifer, red serpent in this case, Nachash. Set it up on a pole. And it shall come to pass that everyone who is bitten, when he looks upon it, when he sees it, he shall live. So Moshe did it. He made a nechash out of a brass, and he set it up on a pole. So that word there is nechashet. He made a nechash, nechashet, out of brass. Came to pass that if a serpent bit somebody, and when he looked upon that serpent of brass, he lived. And the children of Israel journeyed. They pitched in a place called Obot. And they journeyed from Obot, pitched at Ehe Abarim in the wilderness, which is in front of Moab, towards the east, towards the sun rising. From there they journeyed. They pitched in the valley of Zered. There they journeyed, pitched on the other side of Arnon in the wilderness that comes out at the border of the Amorites. That's the border of Moab, between Moab and the Amorites. Wherefore, it is said in the book of the wars of Yahuwah, here's another one of those books that, as far as we know, we don't have, well, certainly it's not considered part of Scripture. I know that there are some texts that are claimed to be at least pieces of it, but for the most part, I don't recall having seen the book of the wars. Anyway, Vaheb in Sufa, the valleys of Arnon, the slope of the valleys that are inclined towards the east, that are towards the seat of Ar, and that lean upon the border of Moab. So from there to Be'er, that's the well where Yahuwah said to Moshe, gather the people together, I'll give them water. And then it says, Israel sang this song, spring up, O well, sing ye unto it. The well which the princes digged, which the nobles of the people delved with the scepter, with their staves, from the wilderness to Matanah, from Matanah to Nahaliel, from Nahaliel to Bamot, from Bamot to the valley. It's in the field by Moab, by the top of Pisgah, which looks down upon the desert. And Israel now sent messengers unto, here's a name we're going to remember, unto Sihon, king of the Amorites. And they said, something like we've heard not long ago, let's pass through your land. We'd like to pass through your land. We won't turn aside into any fields, nor into vineyards. We won't drink of the water of your wells. We'll just go by the king's highway and till we have passed by your border. Now, Sihon does not have quite the same status in the eyes of Yahuwah that Edom does. Remember, he comes at least from a line that comes through Abraham. So Sihon wouldn't allow it. He would not suffer them to pass through his border. Sihon instead gathered all of his people together. They went out against Israel into the wilderness, Bamidbar. They came to Yahaz and there fought against Israel. And it says Israel smote Sihon and his people with the English says with the edge of the sword. Now, as you know, this is one of those words that I think is kind of fascinating in the Hebrew. The expression is lefi cherev. So cherev is sword. Lefi is literally with the mouth of the sword. So for some reason, the English usually translates the edge of the sword rather than the mouth of the sword. But I can't help but think the mouth of the sword, since it devours much blood, much flesh, is a pretty fitting translation. It also tends to be consistently used. We're going to see one exception. It's actually coming up in this Torah portion and the climax next week, where in general, that's the interesting exception part here we'll get to. In general, though, the lefi cherev, the mouth of the sword, is used to devour pagans. It's just with the sword when Israel fights internally. So they possessed the land of Sihon, from the Arnon unto the Yabbok, the river, even unto the children of Ammon, for the Ammonites. The border of the children of Ammon was strong.
So Israel took all of these cities, and Israel dwelt in all the cities of the Amorites, in Heshbon and all the towns thereof. Because Heshbon was the city of Sihon, king of the Amorites, who had fought against the former king of Moab, taken all of his land out of his hand, even unto the Arnon. So they say in the parables, come on to Heshbon. Let the city of Sihon be built and established, for a fire is gone out of Heshbon, a flame from the city of Sihon. It's devoured Ar of Moab, the lords of the high places of Arnon. Woe to you, Moab! You're undone! O people of Chemosh, he's given his sons as fugitives and his daughters into captivity unto Sihon, king of the Amorites. We've shot at him. Heshbon has perished, even unto Dibon, laid waste to the Nophah, and reacheth to the Medeba. Thus, it says, Israel dwelt in the land of the Amorites. So Sihon came out against him. That was the end of him. Moshe then was sent to spy out Yazir. And they took the towns thereof. They drove out the Amorites that were there. And they turned, and they went up to another guy we're going to recognize this name. They went up by way of Bashan. And Og, the king of Bashan, went out against him, he and all his people, to battle at Edrei. And Yahuwah said unto Moshe, don't fear him, because I have delivered him into your hand, all of his people and his land. And notice the contrast, folks. Took them 40 years to figure this out, but we're not seeing the same repeat of the spies and the bad report, and oh, they're big dudes. Og was a big dude. We're going to remember that here, and it's going to be repeated coming up. But fear not. And indeed they didn't, and he didn't last. So you'll do to him just like you did unto Sihon, king of the Amorites, who dwelt at Heshbon. So they smote him, and his sons, all his people, and there was nothing left of him remaining. And they possessed his land. Now, the children of Israel then journeyed, and they pitched in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan River at Jericho. And that takes us to the end of what is actually this Torah portion, but I didn't actually mention it up front. I guess I should have. This week is a double Torah portion. And I got to admit, I think this is kind of a, let's say it's a big combination. There's a lot of material here. And in a way, I'm kind of sad because it's too much, literally, for 1 week worth of study. Because each of these two parashot deserves a lot of time for themselves. So we're going to have to go rapidly through the second one as well. At least, though, this one is fairly famous. We've all heard it. And it's called Parsha Balak because it says, They saw Balak, son of Zippor, all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Now, who is Balak? He is a king. Moab, it says, was sore afraid of the people because there are so many of them. Moab was overcome with dread because of the B'nai Israel. And Moab said unto the elders of Midian, now, will this multitude lick up all that's around us like an ox licks up the grass of the field? And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of Moab at that time. So I guess what they're saying is when it's Moab that says something, it's literally Balak, king of Moab, that is being referred to. So he, the king, sent messengers to a fellow named Balaam. Balaam. Okay, Balaam is how you'll hear it in English, but I like the Hebrew term here. And I have joked about it in the past. I think this is at least an appropriate way to understand. This guy was well known. He was literally kind of famous, like an evangelical preacher of his day, right? He had his own equivalent of lots of money and television time. He was a kind of self-possessed, hot stuff. So they sent messengers to this guy, Balaam, son of Beor, to Pethor, which is by the river, to the land of the children of his people, to call him. And they said, hey, behold, there's a lot of folks coming up out of Egypt. Behold, they cover the face of the earth, and they abide over against me, right up against Moab. So therefore, come on down, I pray you. Curse for me this people, because they are just plain too mighty for me. Peradventure, I might prevail. And we might smite them together. In other words, we might smite them, that I might drive them out of the land, because I know. Now listen to this, and remember, the televangelist preacher, have we heard about anybody else in Scripture which at least has a kind of a similar thing said about him? I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. Does sound a lot like he's kind of trying to abscond with some of the commentary associated with Abraham. The elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the rewards of divination in their hands. So they got some good pagan stuff to give to old Balaam. They came unto him, and they spoke to him the words of the king, Balak. And he said to them, you all stay here tonight. Lodge here. I'll bring back word as Yahuwah may speak to me. So he's going to go claim that he's going to speak to Yahuwah. Indeed, in fact, he does. And the princes of Moab abode with Balaam. And it says, Elohim came to Balaam, and he said, now this is a rhetorical question, obviously. I think he knows. What men are these with you? Okay, and Rashi's comment, put it in a modern vernacular, is it looks like what Rashi is suggesting is happening here is Yah's given Balaam a little bit of rope, if you will. He says, well, Balak, son of Zippor, king of Moab, sent to me and said, behold, the people that come out of Egypt cover the face of the earth. Now, come curse me so that peradventure I just might be able to fight against them and drive them out. And Elohim says to Balaam, here are the words in red that really at least set the tone for everything else that's going to happen. You shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they, in fact, are blessed. And the word that's used in here, go with them, is imahem, go with them. And the implication, say the Hebrew scholars, is that go with them has the implication with this Hebrew phrasing of with a purpose. In other words, it's not just you happen to be in the same direction, you know, like, hey, we're headed in the same direction, can we take a cab together? No, this is to go with them with a common purpose. Do not do that, because they are blessed. So Balaam rose up in the morning. He said to the princes of Balak, get on back to your land, because Yahuwah refuses to give me leave to go with you. And well, most folks look at this and say, yeah, that's at least a partial truth. He's on the right track. Okay, he says you are not to go with him. So that at least is kind of true. Yahuwah refuses to give me leave to go with you. So the princes of Moab rose up, they went to Balak, and they said, hey, you know what? Balaam refuses to come with us. So, this time, Balak sent more princes, more of them, and even more honorable than the first one. So, higher ranking guys. They came to Balaam, and they said to him, thus says Balak, son of Zippor, let nothing, I pray you, hinder you from coming unto me, because I will promote you to very great honor. And whatever you say to me, I'll do. In other words, name your price. Dude, I'll cross your palm with silver. Come before me, therefore, I pray, and curse me this people. Now, obviously, this has some effect on Balak. He's thinking on Balaam. He answers, and he says to the servants of Balak, almost to me, folks, sounds like he's dickering, right? Hey, look, if Balak was to give me, how about this for starting negotiation? If he was to give me his whole house full of silver and gold, I just can't do it. I can't go beyond the word of Yahuwah, my El, to do anything, small or great. He names a price, even though he says, I can't do it. Now, therefore, I pray you all stay here tonight. Wait a second. Do you see where this is headed? Is this look like a problem? So I pray you stay here tonight. If the answer is no, what's the point of having them stay unless just it's a long trip? Maybe you guys just need to rest because I'm not changing my mind. Now, that's not what he says. You stay here tonight so that I might know what Yahuwah will speak unto me if he has anything more to say. He's already got an answer. He doesn't need to hear again. He's been told. Now, Elohim came to Balaam at night, and he said to him, if the men come to call you, rise up and go with them. And, by the way, this is a different way of phrasing, go with them. It's, otem, not of the same purpose, notice. But, listen carefully, only the word which I speak to you, that you shall do. So you're not going to be of common purpose. Only though if they come to call on you, you can go with them. So what happens? Not exactly what the requirements were. Balaam sounds like he could be a high-ranking administration official, right? He rose up in the morning, saddled his ass, and he went with the princes of Moab. Doesn't say they came to him. And obviously the next verse explains, you can kind of see why, Elohim's anger was kindled because he went. He did not listen. He didn't do what he was supposed to do. Second time in this Torah portion, we're seeing somebody who didn't quite listen and do what he was told. The Malach of Yahuwah placed himself in the way for a Satan, literally an adversary, le Satan, against him. Now, this is almost, well, this is probably one of the most humorous stories in a way in all of Scripture. Remember, this is the great televangelist. This is the guy whose rep is far and wide. He speaks to God. He knows, boy, he's on board with things. Elohim's anger was kindled. He sends his messenger who puts himself in the way as an adversary against him. Does Bilaam see it? Doesn't sound like it. Now, he was riding upon his ass. He had two servants with him. And the ass, though, and an ass, by the way, is a female donkey. Yes, we find the word is kind of funny in context, and I will use the word. It is the correct word to use. And I think also it makes the story more poignant to understand the real word, even though people might say, well, that word sounds offensive. Folks, it's supposed to. And moreover, I will contend the reason that the word ass sounds offensive is because Balaam's ass is smarter than he is. Wait. Yeah. Wait for it. Think about it. The whole reason, in other words, I believe that part of the story resonates is because, in other words, the words have the meaning they do through the centuries because of this story. And it's the very fact that Balaam's ass is such a big player in the story that kind of resonates through the centuries to us. So I love the story for that reason. Okay, so the ass sees the angel of Yahuwah standing in the way with his sword drawn in his hand. And the ass, pun intended, saves Bilaam's ass. He turns aside out of the way. He goes into the field. Bilaam doesn't like it one bit. He smites the ass to turn her back the way he wants to go. Now this time, says, the Malach of Yahuwah stood in a hollow way between vineyards. We had a fence on one side and a fence on the other side. Then again, the ass sees the angel of Yahuwah, and she thrusts herself into the wall. And this time, crushes Bilaam's foot against the wall, and he smites her again. He is some kind of angry. Now at this point, the Malach of Yahuwah goes further. He stood in a narrow place where there was just plain no room to turn either to the right hand nor to the left. So we're going to have a confrontation here. The ass, again, sees the Malach of Yahuwah, and now she lays down under Bilaam. And he is some kind of PO'd. He's angry. He smites the ass with his staff. Now at this point, this is, again, every time I read this, you gotta appreciate the sense of humor of the Almighty. You gotta appreciate the sense of humor of the ass, who has just saved Bilaam's ass three times. And what does she get for it? This is a great ass, folks. She gets beat. And Yahuwah finally says, I'm gonna open her mouth, let her talk to this guy. And he does. And the ass then says unto Bilaam, what have I done to you that you have smitten me now these three times? Now, I think it's almost, it's beyond humorous. Here is the answer. Bilaam doesn't seem at all surprised. He responds. He's conversing with the ass. He says, because you've mocked me. If there was a sword in my hand by now, I swear I'd have killed you. So the ass then says to Bilaam, think about this. Now, I'm gonna paraphrase just a bit. Am I not your ass, upon whom you've ridden all your life long up until this day? And have I ever done anything like this before? Well, he says, nope, not that I can think of. Then Yahuwah opened the eyes of Bilaam. And now the great prophet of Yah, finally having been blind, now he sees. He sees the Malach of Yahuwah standing there in that narrow place with his sword drawn in his hand. And he realizes just how close he came to having his head cleaved from his body with that sword. He bows his head and he fell on his face. And the Malach of Yahuwah said unto him, why now have you smitten this fine ass? He didn't say it that way, but I think this is a great animal, folks. Why have you smitten her three times? Behold, I have come forth for an adversary, as le Shatan unto you, because your way is contrary unto me. And the ass, she saw me, turned aside from me these three times. And you know what? If she hadn't turned aside from me by now, I'd have slain you and saved her alive. Bilaam then says to the Malach of Yahuwah, as if it's not finally clear, I have sinned, for I didn't know that it was you that stood there in the way against me. Now, therefore, if it displeases you, I'll get myself on back. And the angel of Yahuwah said unto Balaam, go with the men. But, you get it, dude? Listen up. Only the word that I shall speak unto you, that you shall speak. And I think, after the confrontation and the near-death experience, maybe Balaam's finally starting to get it. So he goes with the princes of Balak. When Balak heard that Balaam had come, he went out to meet him in Ir Moab, which is on the border of Arnon, at the uttermost part. Balak says to Balaam, didn't I earnestly send unto you to call you? Why didn't you come? Have I not indeed able to promote you to honor? Hey, can't I do what I say? Balaam then says to Balak, look, I have come unto you. Have I now any power at all to speak anything? The word that Elohim puts in my mouth, that shall I speak. So, yep, he has gotten the message. Balaam went with Balak. They came to a place called Kiriat Huzot. And Balak sacrificed oxen and sheep. He sent to Balaam and to the princes that were with him. And it came to pass in the morning that Balak took Balaam. He brought him up to a place called Bamot Baal. And from there, he saw the utmost part of the people. So he brought him to a vantage point. And as chapter 23 begins, Balaam says to Balak, all right, make me 7 altars. Build them here. Prepare me 7 bulls and 7 rams. So Balak the king did as Balaam had spoken. And Balak and Balaam offered on every altar a bullock and a ram. And Balaam then says to Balak, stand by your burnt offering and I'll go. Peradventure, Yahuwah will come to meet me, and whatsoever he shows me, I will tell you. So he went to a bare height, and Elohim met Balaam, and he said to him, I've prepared these 7 altars, and I've offered up a bull and a ram on every altar. And Yahuwah put a word in Balaam's mouth, and he said, return to Balak, and here's what you shall speak. So Balaam did. He went to the king, he stood by his burnt offering, he and all the princes of Moab. He took up his parable, and he said the following, from Aram, Balak brings me, the king of Moab from the mountains of the east. Come, cursed me, Yaakov, and come, execrate. That's the first time this word appears in Scripture. Execrate Israel. And that word here is zoma. Execrate. Sounds like a pretty powerful word, right? Do something really nasty. Take them, rake them over the coals. How, he asks, here comes the, in this case, it's probably the primo element of the prophetic response. How shall I curse whom Elohim has not cursed? And how shall I execrate when Yahuwah himself has not execrated? For from the top of the rocks I see him, and from the hills I behold him, and lo, it's a people that shall dwell alone. Now, some of the Midrash says, well, it's a people content to be alone, faithful to the distinction, to the identity that has been given them. But in any case, that's what the prophecy is. It's a people that shall dwell alone, and they shall not be reckoned among the Goyim, the nations. Who has counted the dust of Yaakov, or numbered the stock of Israel? Let me die the death of the righteous, and let my end be like his. That sounds like quite a compliment. So Balak seems to figure it is too. He says to Balaam, hey, what have you done to me? I told you to curse my enemies, and behold, you have altogether blessed them. And Balaam answered, and he said, look, must I not take heed to speak that which Yahuwah puts in my mouth? Balak then says to him, okay, all right, come on, I pray you, come with me unto another place. We'll go somewhere else, we'll try it again. From there, you can see more of them. There you'll see but the utmost part of them, and you will not see them all, and you can curse them for me from there. So he took him into the field of Zophim, to the top of Pisgah, and again they built 7 altars, offered a bull and a ram on every altar, and he, Balaam, says to Balak, the king, stand by here by the burnt offering, while I go towards a meeting over yonder. Yahuwah then met Balaam, and he put a word in his mouth, and he said, return to Balak, and here is what you shall speak. So he came to him, and lo, he stood by his burnt offering. The princes of Moab were with him, and Balak said unto him, hey, what has Yahuwah spoken? So he took up his parable, and he said, arise, Balak, and hear. Give ear unto me, you son of Zippor. And here we go. God is not a man that he should lie, neither the son of man that he should repent. When he has said, will he not do it? Or when he has spoken, will he not make it good? Behold, I am bidden to bless. And when he has blessed, I can't call it back. None has beheld iniquity, Torahlessness in Yaakov, neither has one seen perverseness in Israel. So here's a reference to both names of the same man or people, if you will, the physical and the spiritual sense, both Jacob and Israel. Nor has one seen perverseness in Israel. Yahuwah, his Elohim, is with him, and the shouting for the king is among them. Elohim, who brought them forth out of Egypt, is for them like the lofty horns of the wild ox. For there is no enchantment with Yaakov, nor is there any divination with Israel. Now it is said of Jacob and of Israel, what hath God wrought? Now, that's another famous expression I always like to point out, because I grew up hearing about this. Samuel F.B. Morse, the fellow that invented Morse code and sent the first radio message, that was exactly the message he sent. First message sent by Morse code. What hath God wrought? Behold, a people that rise up as a lioness, and as a lion does he lift himself up. He shall not lie down until he eats of the prey and drinks the blood of the slain. Kind of reminds us of the mouth of the sword, right? Balak said unto Balaam, don't curse him at all, nor bless him at all. In other words, better you just didn't do anything than do this, guy. But Balaam answered, and he said to Balak, look, didn't I tell you, saying, all that Yahuwah speaks, that I must do? And then Balak says unto Balaam, come on now, I'll take you to a different place. And I got to figure two times. And he hadn't gotten the message yet. But we're going to try it a third time. We'll see if the third time is the charm. That's a pagan-sounding thing, right? So I'm going to take you to someplace else. Peradventure, it'll please God this time, yeah, sure, that you might curse him from there for me. So Balak took Bilaam unto the top of Peor that looks down upon the desert. This is literally the home, the high seat, if you will, of Baal worship. Baal of Peor. The Lord of Peor at the top of the mountain. Balaam then says to Balak, build me here, what else? Seven altars, prepare me seven more bulls and seven more rams. So Balak did, as Balaam had said. They offered up a bull and a ram on every altar. We've seen this part of the story before. Then when Balaam saw that it pleased Yahuwah to bless Israel, he didn't go, as at the other times, to meet with enchantments, but instead he set his face towards Ha-Midbar, the wilderness. And Balaam lifted up his eyes, and he saw Israel dwelling tribe by tribe, and the spirit of Elohim came upon him. The Ruach Elohim came upon him. He took up his parable, and he said. Now, this is now one of the most famous blessings, folks, in all of Scripture. Here's what he said. The saying of Balaam, the son of Beor, the saying of the man whose eye is opened, as if... Yeah, he certainly needed that. Remember, he didn't see the Malach when his ass did, and it almost cost him. Now his eye is opened. The saying of him who hears the words of Yahuwah, who sees the visions of the Almighty, fallen down yet with opened eyes. Here we go. How goodly are your tents, O Yaakov, your dwellings, O Israel, as valleys stretched out, as gardens by the riverside, as aloes planted of Yahuwah, as cedars besides the waters, water shall flow from his branches, and his seed shall be in many waters, and his king shall be higher than a Gog, and his kingdom shall be exalted. Elohim, who brought him forth out of Egypt, Mitzrayim is for him like the lofty horns of the wild ox. He shall eat up the nations, the Goyim, that are his adversaries, and shall break their bones in pieces and pierce them through with arrows. He couched, he lay down as a lion, and as a lioness, who shall rouse him up? Blessed be every one that blesses you, and cursed be every one that curses you. Now, you got to love that, right? This is now the third time that we've seen this reference. The first one having to do with Abraham. Then it was kind of absconded with, I've heard, he said of the televangelist, Balaam himself, that those whom you bless are blessed, those whom you curse are cursed. And now, Balaam is setting it straight. Blessed be everyone that blesses you, talking of Yaakov and Israel. And cursed be everyone that curses you. Now, as you might expect, Balak, he's kind of had it. His anger was kindled against Balaam, and he smote his hands together. And Balak said unto Balaam, look, man, I called you to curse my enemies, and behold, you have altogether blessed them these three times now. Now, isn't it funny? as I read this, and I guess, you know, the parallels here ought to be clear. What was it that happened with Balaam's ass? All right, three times she had to stop him from getting killed. Eventually, she lays down under him. Three times, I saved your ass. And now, he's taken Balak, literally to the cleaners, taken him to the mountaintop. Seven more bulls, seven more rams. Curse mine enemies. And now you have altogether blessed them these three times. So it took three times for everybody in the story to figure it out. I wonder if Balak has figured it out. Now, therefore, flee. Get home. Go on back to your place. I was going to promote you to great honor, but no, man, you wouldn't have it. Yahuwah has kept you back from honor. And I have a note in my margins, irony. Yeah. Yahuwah has kept you back from honor. Yahuwah has basically saved his life. Balaam then said to Balak, didn't I tell you? I spoke to your messengers that you sent unto me, and I said, if Balaam could give me his whole house full of silver and gold, I can't go beyond the word of Yahuwah to do either good or bad in my own mind. What Yahuwah speaks, well, that's what I got to speak. So now, behold, I go unto my people. Come, and I will announce to you what this people shall do to your people in the end of days. You haven't had enough yet? Here you go. So he took up his parable, and he said, the saying of Balaam, the son of Beor, the saying of the man whose eye is opened. This is the second time he said this. The saying of him who hears the words of Yahuwah, who knows the knowledge of the Most High, who sees the vision of the Almighty, fallen down, yet with opened eyes, I see him, but not now. I behold him, but not nigh. There shall step forth a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite through the corners of Moab, and break down all the sons of Set. And Edom shall be a possession, Seir also, even his enemies shall be a possession, while Israel doeth valiantly. Out of Jacob shall one have dominion, and shall destroy the remnant from the city. And he looked on Amalek, and he took up his parable, and he said, Amalek was the first of the nations, but his end shall come to destruction. And he looked on the Kenite, he took up his parable, and he said, though firm be your dwelling places, and though your nest be set in the rock, nevertheless, Cain shall be wasted. How long? Asher shall carry you away captive. And he took up his parable, and he said, alas, who shall live after Elohim has appointed him? But ships shall come from the coast of Kittim, and they shall afflict Asher, and shall afflict Eber, and he also shall come to destruction. And the Torah portion ends, at least for now, with these words. And I'm going to suggest, we'll talk about this one next week, but it ain't over yet. Actually, it might be 2 weeks on down. The end of the story comes in Numbers chapter 31. So we got a ways later. We're going to find out that Balaam is this kind of a, there's a kind of a Clintonian aspect to him. It all depends on what the meaning of the word. You don't say what I'm not going to tell them is. Because he found a way to get people to curse themselves, even if he wasn't allowed to do it. I guess there was still quite a bit of filthy lucre involved. So, for now at least, it says, Balaam rose up, he went, he returned to his place. He went and returned to his place. That's kind of a one of those double-edged phrases in the language. And Balak also went his way. So, again, for now, that is where the Torah portion ends.